Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Now it's my first sponsor, Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company. Welcome, Robin.
Yay! Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and very happy to be your sponsor. We have a large variety of locally adapted, open-pollinated, non-GMO vegetable, flower, and herb seeds. And we hope you'll enjoy visiting our website, goodseedco.net or Good Seed Montana, and seeing the resources that we offer for becoming a better gardener, a better seed saver, and a member of building resiliency around food in your community.
Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am very excited to bring on a guest who, Allison Parker from Radical Root Farm in Illinois talked about the Liberty Prairie Foundation and how that kind of helped them get their start. So I reached out to them, and today Mike Sands is here to tell us about his farming experiences as well as about the foundation. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're super glad to have you here because I think you're going to be just full of a wealth of information for listeners. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and like how you got started maybe or where you're at? And I don't know.
Sure. I'm older than I should be, and started in agriculture back in kind of 1970, 71, and originally was doing a lot of work internationally. So I worked overseas in Kenya and Panama, and my family and I lived where our kids.
Okay, so I lost you. Right where you, like after the second sentence, you were saying you work internationally.
Yeah, my early work was overseas. My wife and I lived in Kenya for 2 years and worked there. Our first son was born there. And then we went to Panama and were in Panama for a number of years, and our second son was born there. So we've been doing kind of farming, gardening. My interest has always been in kind of higher intensity, more biologically based farming systems from the beginning. And we've always been interested in kind of how do you integrate farming and agriculture into community development. So we've been doing a lot of different things and ended up after spending 10 years at the Rodale Institute at the research center there, ended up in Illinois working to do all kinds of fun stuff there. So that's the really short version of how we got to Illinois and working with the foundation, working with a place called Prairie Crossing, the development of a new community called Prairie Crossing, and using that as a platform for helping beginning farmers like Allison and Alex.
Okay. I'm not even sure where to start. How did you end up in Kenya? Like with the Peace Corps? Or like, it sounds so exciting.
No,
did
I was doing graduate work.
Nice.
I was supposed to be actually in Ecuador, but things changed at the last minute, and I got sent to Kenya to run a project there based in the Ministry of Livestock Development, the Kenyan Ministry of Livestock Development, starting a goat, dual-purpose goat research program for them.
How exciting. Was it as exciting as it sounds?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, you know, everything in life should be an adventure. And that was one.
But people dream about getting to go to Africa. Like, were you in, like, the city or in the country, the rural area?
No, we were way out in the rural area. We were out near the Ugandan border. If you look at Kenya, Nairobi is the capital, and it's kind of in the center of the country. And on the western edge is a giant lake called Lake Victoria, and that it shares with Tanzania and Uganda. And we were right near the Ugandan border in a little town called Maseno, Kenya.
Like, what's little? Like 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people?
God, I don't know how many. Thousands of people, but in terms of infrastructure, you know, not even really a main, kind of a half of a main street. Mm-hmm. In the township there, I mean, remember, at this point in time, Kenya was probably the fastest growing country in the world. And so there are people all over, but they're all on little small farms of maybe 2 to 3 acres, just checkerboard across the landscape.
Okay.
So very rural, but still lots of people.
Uh-huh. Well, I've read, you know, several books about, like, Wangari Maathai, who she's mm-hmm. from there. Probably, is it the same time?
Same time.
Right?
Wangari Maathai was just starting her Green Belt movement, planting trees and organizing people, primarily east of us, near the, kind of in the suburbs and in the highlands around Nairobi.
Wow, how exciting. Okay, and then Panama, and then the Rodale Institute. You got to tell me about that, because I just love Rodales.
Well, I went there with a colleague by the name of Ken Tall. The two of us were charged with starting an international program. They, at that point, didn't have an international program. They were doing the private side. The publishing company was doing its books and magazines, and they had a nonprofit side working on both health and food and gardening, farming research, all focused on organic lifestyles and organic production. And they were very interested. They were being approached all the time to do some international work, but didn't have a real program. And so Ken and I were brought on to start an international program, and I worked on that for about 4 or 5 years, and then moved over to a managing director role for the entire institute, both the domestic and the international.
Wow. All right. Okay. Well, all right, let's go back to the basics. So I always kind of like to ask listeners at the beginning to tell us about, like, your very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, where did you start?
I didn't really start gardening until college. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the country. I think we probably had a garden, although I don't really remember it very much. I was too busy playing out in the woods, I guess. But after college, I was working odd jobs, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, and had a large garden at that point, started a large garden, kind of challenged myself to in New Hampshire to produce enough food so that I could eat something from the garden every single day of the year.
Nice.
That was fun. It was an eye-opening experience. My downside was I developed a recipe that I really liked for turnip parsnip soup. And I decided, well, I'd make a whole lot of it and can it. And I didn't do a good enough job of heating the during the canning process, and it started to ferment and blew up in my couple months later in the basement.
I'll bet that didn't smell pretty either.
No, that was that was not a good
fermented team. Turnips. Mm. All right, cool. Well, all right. So then, do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
I think it means lots of things, but at its core, organic gardening, organic farming, isn't so much about not using something. It's much more about how to build biologically based systems and harvest something out of that. So whether it's in large scale farms or in your backyard, it's starting with building a really healthy soil through the use of focus on kind of organic matter production, augmentation in the garden, diversity, and then kind of managing that process. In reality, it's a lot more complex than conventional gardening or farming, but it's also much more rewarding.
Okay. Do you want to tell us what inspired you or who inspired you to start, you know, using organic techniques? Was it at the Rodale place or in Kenya earlier or even like back in college in New Hampshire?
It was a little of kind of all along. There were parts of it that were based on, you know, when I was in New Hampshire, it was just a lot easier to take the neighbor's sheep manure and mix that into the soils, and in a garden setting where you have lots of diversity anyway, particularly in new gardens, and there's not a huge pest buildup, it was pretty easy. When I was doing work overseas, I probably wasn't philosophically committed to organic per se, but because of the circumstances and the need to develop productive systems that didn't require a lot of outside inputs because they simply weren't available, you became kind of focused on what is the basis of organic agriculture, even if you're not explicitly talking about it, because you're looking for systems that recycle nutrients, recycle the waste from one process becomes an input into another, and you're in essence almost forced into that kind of focus on the system. So it started early. Certainly, working at Rodale was, at that point, incredibly reinforced. I mean, it was a huge focus, a single-minded focus on organic. We didn't really do anything else. But we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it was that was were the critical pieces of organic. From a science basis, from a biology perspective. And that's what I've been working with ever since. I still probably in my heart committed to organic systems, but I do recognize the need at some points in some systems to look at inputs that are not certified organic to try and jumpstart a system sometimes, but not build a system that's dependent on those outside inputs.
Okay. I guess I'm kind of curious a little bit about the international part because, you know, I do have quite a few listeners who are, you know, not in America, around the world. So Is there anything that you would say, because nobody's really talked about that, like if you're in another country or anything that, you know, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, it's just, I don't think there's anything specific to international in comparison to work in the U.S. One way or the other. I think, you know, they're depending on where internationally, if you're in a an area in the tropics where you don't have winter and I say that as I look out and I got like 30 some inches of snow blowing around us here in Virginia right now. But over, you know, in the tropics, you don't have that cold winter. So there are potentially larger challenges with pest buildup, warmer temperatures typically facilitate the metabolism of organic matter by bacterial and microbial populations, so it's harder to build high organic matter soils in the tropics. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are great opportunities, huge responses to additions of organic material. And so there's all kinds of opportunities that way, too. So it's, I don't think it's specific to international. It's the same kinds of struggles or challenges that we have when you go from working in Alaska, where you have obviously a winter that's complete, and but then during the summer you have these very long days, and you can grow a cabbage that's huge because it keeps photosynthesizing 24 hours a day, basically. To working in South Florida on soils that are devoid almost of organic matter. So, you know, it's all over the place. And you just have to be adaptive and look to that natural environment wherever you are as the kind of basis for how you start to build a productive system.
Oh, cool. Okay. I think that helps. So I also, my other question is, because my husband and I just got 4 sheep. This is our first year. We got them, like, I think in October. And you were telling me in the email yesterday that you had sheep. So, like, how, where are you now? Like, how big is your place now? Like, an acre? A lot? You have sheep, so it must be at
least. It's big. Okay. I have about 100 acres of pasture. And I got about 250 sheep out there right now.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So, like,
they're sitting there wondering when the snow's going to stop and they can get back to grazing, but other than that.
Okay. Well, can you tell me anything about raising sheep? Like, what kind of, we got Shetland sheep.
Okay. We raise 2 different breeds of hare sheep.
Cool.
Where we are, there is essentially no market for wool, and I used to shear sheep, and I don't have a real interest in shearing 250 sheep. But if you hire someone to shear sheep around here, it costs more than the wool that you harvest is worth. So we decided to focus on hare sheep. They're primarily for local markets, for lamb, and we have a pretty intensive rotation practice where the animals move to a new piece of pasture every day. So they're in very small, they're a large flock, but on a very small area for a very short period of time. So I'll have maybe 50 to 75,000 pounds of sheep on an acre for 24 hours, and then they'll move to another acre. So with 100 acres, it may be as much as 45 to 50 days of rest between the time that they graze any particular paddock.
Okay.
And we try to graze all year round. So we put a little bit of hay up just for storms like today. But the rest of the time, the animals are grazing. And they can graze through about 6 inches of snow without any problem, as long as it's good grass underneath. But 36 is pushing them. In fact, the lambs this morning were having trouble even moving.
So, like baby lamb, like how, like when do they get born? We're thinking.
Yeah, these are, most of my lambs are born in March.
They are, okay.
Late March. But I also do a small lambing, a smaller number of ewes lamb in October, November, so that we have some meat for some lamb for sale from now through June, when the rest of our lambs will start to be ready.
Okay. So then what else? Like, do you just have sheep? Do you have other animals, or do you have, and then you have a garden?
We also graze cattle. But I don't, I do what's called custom grazing cattle. So I don't actually own the cattle. I work with, other producers who own the cattle, who are looking to, in essence, rent pasture. So they pay me a fee per day per animal to graze cattle with my sheep. And that has a real benefit for the... I do it in part because of the finances, the economics, but more importantly is I get a better interaction with the pasture, because the cattle eat slightly different things than the sheep. We get a more complete utilization of the pasture and a greater disturbance. And so over time, the pastures become more productive with multi-species grazing than they do with single-species grazing.
Okay, cool. That's good to know. Mike was reading yesterday, my husband Mike, and because I've been getting him some sheep books, and something about maybe getting a donkey to go with the sheep, or something about a llama or a donkey would be good. But he, I don't know, he wanted to show me this picture of a donkey. I remember this morning.
So did you have problems with coyotes or domestic dogs as predators?
We have not yet, but we could, we're in the woods. We have 20 acres and we're surrounded by people who pretty much all have, like, you know, 20 or, you know, 10, 20, 30 acres. So they're, you know, we're fairly, coyotes certainly run through, you know, animals go through. So we don't know.
Yeah.
This is our first year. And, I don't know.
Well, over time, you may want to think about a donkey or a llama or a guard dog to protect against, predators.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of coyotes and bears here. And we use guard dogs. We have four Anatolian shepherds. They're a Turkish breed that live with the sheep year-round.
Outside. Yeah, he also saw somewhere a big white sheepdog. Because we have two dogs.
That's probably a Pyrenee.
But, of course, they sleep in... Yeah, I think it was. But my dogs sleep in the house, so we might have to get them their own special little guard dog.
Yeah, no, if you want to do with a guard dog, you want to, there are breeds that have been bred for guarding, and a regular dog will not work.
No.
So you really need to get that. And they, I mean, they're literally outdoors all the time. And, you know, every once in a while someone complains and says, well, you're being harsh. It's like, I can't tell you, when I went up today, my dogs, with the snow and the cold, they were the happiest they've been all year round. They have access to the barn, and they don't spend any time in the barn. They're out all the time and having a ball. So.
Cool. Yeah, I'll bet they are. Okay. Well, so then do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year? And, like, how many acres are you farming? Are you just, like, for your family right now, or are you selling produce and vegetables?
No, no, we're just, we just grow produce for our own use. We don't grow any produce for commercial use. Our commercial is strictly the sheep and cattle. But, no, we had a great year. This is... we had, you know, a pretty dry August, so things like our tomatoes did beautifully. We had no problems with any of the blight problems that we sometimes have in wetter years. We had great flavor because of the drought and the dry weather. So probably the peppers and tomatoes were our special crop this year.
And is there something you're excited to try different next year? Something you want to do new?
I think that our constant kind of focus is how to intensify. It's not specific for next year, but our goal is to grow more and more on smaller and smaller garden spaces. We figure the more we can get in and the more we can get growing of things we want, the less room there are for weeds.
That's so true.
That's our focus.
Mm-hmm. And also the less water that you need. I always feel like, because we had a really big water shortage for many years, and so I always feel like we had less weeds because we focused on watering just on the roots. Like any water that was, when you haul water for a garden, it's only going where it needs to go. You're very specific about it. Do you want to tell us about something that didn't quite so work so well this season, like that didn't come out the way you thought it was gonna, or anything?
Potatoes did lousy this year, but and I'm not really sure why. May have been neglect, but that would probably be the greatest or the single thing that was a disappointment. Everything else was, this was a great year for gardening for us in Northern Virginia. You could hardly go wrong.
Nice. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time?
Well, the standard is kale. I mean, I can grow dinosaur kale or lanceolata kale with my eyes closed. that's, for me, the easiest, absolutely the easiest thing in the world to grow. After that would probably be zucchini, and some of the winter squashes are pretty easy for our environment.
Okay. How about something you'd steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
In our climate, I think the things that I would steer people away from are some of the berries are tough to grow. Blueberries are a real challenge in our area. Blackberries, we get lots of vegetative growth and not much fruit production. What else do we have trouble with? I think cauliflower is probably one of the hardest vegetables to really grow well.
Why is that?
I don't know. I've never had good. I have great luck with broccoli and kale and the other brassicas, but cauliflower befuddles me.
We had a good a cauliflower year this year, but usually that's one of our tougher ones. And especially this year because it was super hot and dry, I was surprised, but maybe the extra water helped us.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, cauliflowers are tough. And I'm always amazed that my husband gets broccoli because especially he starts by seed, but he grows quite a bit of yummy broccoli. Okay, how about what's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you got to force yourself to get out there and go do?
Least favorite. I think weeding is always my least favorite. That's why I kind of, we're always focusing on how to grow more intensively to reduce weeds and reduce weeding. I don't find weeding much fun.
So are there any like secret tricks you're going to try this year to grow more intensively? Something you're going to do differently to make those beds produce more?
Yeah, we're gonna. It's what we've always been doing. We're kind of constantly focusing on how to play with the structure of plants, so heights and growing patterns, and then how can you integrate those in ways that work. So vining, starting taller plants and then vining plants underneath those. To cover the soil, things like that. That's probably our biggest, our constant kind of area of innovation.
Nice. I've had a few guests lately talk about the, what is it called? The three, it's not the three beans.
Three sisters?
Yeah, the three sisters and growing, like, you know, is it pumpkins
beans
or squash?
And pumpkins and corn. Yep.
Yeah, so that they kind of work in symbiosis like that, right? Where there's, you know, things shading and growing at the same time and kind of all growing together. Yep. Cool.
So it's that same idea and then just extending it to include greater diversity. There's a farmer who I know from his farming stuff out in North Dakota, a guy named Gabe Brown, who's probably, I think, one of the pioneers in the world. He's a large-scale farmer. I mean, this is not a guy playing around in small acreages. He's probably growing 2,000 or 3,000 acres of crops and livestock and cover crops and all kinds of stuff together. And his garden is hysterical. It's, you and I would have a hard time calling it a garden because he basically takes all the different things he wants to grow and he takes them out into the field, into his area that he calls his garden, and he just spreads seed all over, rakes it all in, waters it, and then it comes up in this just jungle of material. And then he harvests by just literally, he never weeds. He waters a little bit if he needs to, and then walks around hunting for stuff in his patch. And he's incredibly productive, but it's you go out and you see it and you just want to laugh. And it's just so much fun. It's like, oh, look at this. I got squash over here. Okay, we'll have squash for dinner. And then, you know, he pokes around. Oh, carrots. Look, I got great carrots. Whoops, wait a minute. That's a carrot. That's a dill, you know, when he's looking at the tops or something. I mean, it is great. And that's how he farms. His larger farm stuff is he works with these cover crop mixes where most farmers will plant one or two species as a cover crop after their corn or their soybeans. He's planting 20 to 30 species of cover crops. And so it's this incredible diversity. Then he'll graze cattle on it. He has strictly grass-fed, doesn't use any grain for cattle. Grass feeds his cover, or he grazes his cover crops with cattle, and then no-till drills his next crop, whether it's a small grain like wheat or soybeans or corn or whatever into that stubble. He hasn't plowed in something like 17 years, and he's got, you know, he's got the best yield averages for corn and soybeans of any farmer in the entire county, and he's, you know, and he's doing it at a huge scale. I mean, this is a guy who can sit in the coffee shop and brag with the best of them.
Nice. Okay. Cool. All right. And then you're gonna try that. That sounds awesome. That's like my kind of garden where there's like, you know, no paths or no like specific rows or anything. And
right.
I'm like the, you know, go to the store and find the whatever transplants are spent and come home and be like, where am I going to put this today? No planning. But and on the flip side, my friend Megan Kane, who's the like ultimate strategist and planner, is going to come on and talk about planning this week, I think, or next week. So, but yeah, awesome. All right. Well then, so what's your favorite activity to do in the garden? I have an idea. I'm curious to know.
Harvest.
I knew it.
Harvest. Actually, I love planting too. Planting and harvesting.
Okay. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received, Michael?
Best gardening advice I've ever received. Probably the Something along the lines of relax. Don't worry about it.
Thanks.
Yeah. It'll work. Something will work. Don't fret. Watch. Learn. Relax.
Perfect. I like that. That's very encouraging and inspirational. And that's been kind of a theme with my show, is that a lot of people talk about, you know, something doesn't work out every year, but you learn a lot and lots of stuff does, and more stuff's going to work out that, you know, and it's going to inspire you to keep going. So I think that fits perfect in with that. How about, do you have a favorite tool? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, is there something that you've been taking with you all these places, or something you can't live without?
Oh, probably some form of stirrupo.
Okay.
Doesn't make sense because I hate weeding, but...
No, it makes perfect sense because that must make it, if you have to do it, the easiest thing to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a favorite recipe or anything you want to share, or secrets for preserving food at all?
No, I don't think so. Not for preserving. I love to cook, but most of my cooking is around meat production and lamb stuff, and lots of kind of Eastern European, Mediterranean recipes.
Oh, you have to share something with listeners. I'm sure they would love to hear something to do with lamb. My husband's always asking me, how do you cook lamb? What do you do with lamb?
Oh, man, there's thousands of things you can do with lamb. My favorite are because I like developing things for cheap cuts of lamb, so ground lamb. There's all kinds of kind of lamb, Middle Eastern lamb meatballs with all kinds of different combinations with either, let's think of any of the, all the spices like turmeric and cardamom and paprika, allspice, all of those are great. I guess one of my favorites, actually, would be lamb shanks with pomegranate and couscous and mint.
Sounds good.
And you just braise it up. It's really easy. Braise up the lamb shanks, put them in the big heavy steel kind of skillet, throw the other stuff in, some stock, some vegetable stock, or you can make yourself, or not, some carrots, and
now wait, but is the couscous cooked already, or the couscous the green?
The couscous you add at the end.
Okay. Already cooked?
No, I usually add it raw. Okay. But it still only takes kind of 20-30 minutes. So this other you simmer for, you know, an hour or two.
And did you say pomegranates? Do those go in at
the
end?
Yeah. Well, the pomegranate seeds go in on the end, but part of the simmering broth is a vegetable stock and pomegranate juice.
Oh, okay. Never heard of cooking with pomegranate.
I'd say one
juice.
Of the things, if people are interested, I have a favorite cookbook, which is called Jerusalem. So anyone who wants to get absolutely fabulous Middle Eastern recipes, that's the cookbook.
Okay. I'll put that link to that in the show notes. Do you have a favorite internet resource that you like to go to?
Not a single source. I go to all different kinds of places regularly searching. I do a lot of stuff. Most of mine is around grass production and grazing and stuff. So a lot of my resources are in that area as opposed to kind of more gardening stuff.
Okay. But
there's,
I just got
a grazing
like,
one
to, like,
called
an extension
on grass.
Place or a grazing one on grass. Okay, cool. Because I'll bet my husband's going to be interested in that for feeding the sheep and stuff and building our pasture and things. On grass, like ongrass.com, huh?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's
or
not quite. But if you search for on grass, you'll find it.
Okay. And
another one actually called the grass whisperer. You know, like that there was a horse whisperer.
Yeah.
There's a grass whisperer.
No way.
That's a good type.
Okay. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog or anything?
I guess, again, it's still more in the farming side, but there's a book called The Stockman Grass Farmer. That's probably the best. And then there's a book. The best book on grass-fed anywhere is a book called Grass-Fed Cattle.
Nice. I think listeners are going to be interested in this.
Good.
And I went down, one of the best experiences I've had since I started my podcast was I went on this farm tour down at this place called the Lower Valley Farm. And that was like the first place I had seen, you know, the animal rotations, and they had their sheep and their cattle like you were. And then there was also the wife did more of the gardening and the husband was more in charge of the farming. But they're just a little place, and I'm sure they would be interested in all of these resources. And so I'm sure there's other listeners that are too. Okay, here we go. The business advice. So tell us about the Liberty Prairie Foundation and
right.
what that is. And
so,
Liberty
Prairie
Foundation. What was
it again?
The Prairie Crossing Farm, right?
Right. The Liberty Prairie Foundation is a what's called a private operating foundation, which just means it's a not-for-profit. And our particular mission is around promoting healthy working landscapes. So healthy both for the environment and for the people who work those landscapes, the farmers or foresters or who's ever working in that landscape. And one of our primary program areas now is helping beginning farmers, whether they're young, new farmers coming out of completely non-farm backgrounds, or whether it's second career folks or whatever. But how do we help them be successful? And how do we minimize the risk for those first couple of years as people try to think and learn how to farm or what they want to do in farming? So if you look around the countryside, you'll see lots of young people in particular working on other people's farms as apprentices, as interns, as farm managers, all of whom have a dream of farming for themselves. They have great practical experience in terms of working the machinery, of planting, harvesting, pest management, fertility management, all the production side. But typically, they then face a huge jump when they want to start farming for themselves. Where are they going to find land? How are they going to assemble the capital? And that's complicated by the fact that they don't have any real experience from a financial business management side to show either a family member who might lend them some money, or a bank, or farm service agency, or farm credit. So they really have to go in and say, you know, trust me, I can do this. What we've decided was one of the things we could offer that would dramatically improve their chances is to give beginning farmers an opportunity to lease a piece of land. In our case, we're focused primarily on vegetable producers, so they're leasing fairly small parcels of land, up to 5 acres, for up to 5 years for commercial vegetable production. They pay for that land on a lease basis. They rent or lease equipment from us. They're their own business people. They're incorporated businesses. They're responsible for all of their management. We're not a training institution. We're basically a business incubator, but for farming instead of for a tech startup. And so someone like Alex and Allison from Radical Root Farm came to us, I think, 6 years ago. And they had worked on other farms. They had incredible passion. And they needed a place to get started, to test themselves, as it were. So we asked them for a business plan. They developed a business plan. We worked with them on that. They identified the markets, how they wanted to sell their produce, all of those business questions. And based on that, we then leased them the first year. I think we probably leased them maybe a half acre, maybe an acre. And then over time, they grew that business to the point where they were leasing a full 5 acres from us. And starting to really make a living out of this. They were both working on the farm by the time they finished with us. And we then worked with them to find another farm where they could be permanently based. They still didn't have the money to buy a farm and still stay within the market area that they wanted, which was Chicago. So we worked with them to find a piece of land that was owned by a not-for-profit, a land conservancy, that was interested in supporting farmers. And they now lease that land. They have a series of rolling 5-year leases, so they always are looking out 5 years at a minimum. And they've grown that business. I think they're growing on kind of 15 acres now. It's a successful commercial enterprise. They market primarily through a CSA and farmers markets. And, you know, it's a great opportunity to get started. And they've been able to get credit now to grow the business because they had 5 years of working with us where they developed, you know, those records, that information, so they could show an annual budget and annual returns and file income taxes based on farming. So that's an example of how that might work for us.
Okay. So if listeners are interested in it, is there something that you would tell them to, like, that, I don't know, kind of like a, not necessarily a warning, but something that wouldn't work, or something that they should be paying attention to, or that they should really, like, have, like,
the biggest thing they should pay attention to is until they've actually, I guess the biggest thing is go slowly. Don't go out and buy a big piece of land that you'll ultimately need to be a successful farmer. Don't buy new equipment. Don't incur a lot of debt. I think I would argue that the best way for farmers, beginning farmers, to start is to actually lease land and lease equipment, so that you're minimizing the debt that you take on and the risk. If something doesn't work, then, you know, in essence, you may decide after doing this for a year or 2 years that, you know, farming's just too hard. It's not what I like doing. I want the social interaction of being at another job. I'd like to do a little hobby work on the side, but, you know, I don't want to be a full-time farmer. If you've already bought a big farm and incurred a lot of debt, you're stuck. If you're leasing land and that doesn't work, basically, you know, you say, hey, this has been a great experiment. I can move on to something else. You don't have a bank loan that with someone is screaming at you to finish paying the mortgage. So that's my my cynical view. Don't incur a lot of debt. At some point, you're going to incur some debt, but you ought to not do that until you know what you're doing.
And I would think another thing people might realize is not as much that it's hard work, but that there's parts of it that they don't like. Like, because you have to be able to market your product. And if you know, there's the whole business piece. If you just want to grow things, unless you have some kind of a team or someone else, you know, there's that piece of it that they might decide they just want as a hobby. Right. Or they might decide, wow, I love it.
Yeah, no, and that, I mean, you're right. And one of the great challenges is that most people are not very good at the business side, don't like the business side. They get into it because they like the growing and being outside and in the field.
Right.
And you've got to do both. And even if you just, you know, at some point you get big enough that, frankly, you start to delegate some things to different things. Delegating the business side is not the end. You're much better off delegating the tractor driving and the planting and seeding. You want to be on top of marketing and finances.
Good point.
You know, that's the, ultimately the most important thing in the business.
And the other thing I was thinking about is that people might want to pivot. Like, my big goal this year was to grow sunflowers to see if I could figure out, and if I had exactly the wherewithal to do sunflowers for market. And immediately I realized, nope, this is not for me. But on this flip side, I pivoted more to thinking like about growing the sunflower seeds for bird seed, because that's more likely going to work for me, to be honest with you. If I can produce enough bird seed that I don't have to buy any this winter, like, but here I am sitting here, like, you know, spending money with all, I grew 750 sunflowers last year and I still am purchasing bird seed, which is to me crazy. So like, how many would it take, you know, to produce? And so people might realize, you know, they like it, but they want to do something totally different. Maybe they want to sell microgreens grown in a greenhouse somewhere instead of having like it, like what they're, so like you said, you know, getting experience, you know, trying it out, leasing it for a few years.
That's exactly it. And what you can do when you don't, if you've invested in a big tractor, it's pretty hard to justify growing microgreens. You know, if you've got a big piece of land, going into hydroponics and greenhouse production probably feels kind of weird because you're paying a mortgage on a whole lot of land and you're growing in, you know, two big greenhouses that, I mean, they're big greenhouses, but maybe they're 100 feet long by 30 feet wide. It's not... You know, it's not justifying the land purchase. So, again, if you can avoid a lot of the debt to start with and allow yourself the flexibility to run through all those options, whether it's growing microgreens or growing flowers or growing bird seed or growing whatever, you have a lot more flexibility to experiment if you haven't... constrained yourself with debt and a location that doesn't work for any of this.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay. Do you want to tell people how they can find out about the Liberty Prairie Foundation, and if they wanted to, like, is there like an application process? Is there like a timeline?
It's very easy. You go to libertyprairie.org and you'll see a whole lot of description of all of the work that we do. And in there, you'll see a section on the Farm Business Development Center. And there's an application process and a calendar laid out for how you might participate. And off you go. And if you're not in an area, you know, where we physically are located, you'll still get lots of good ideas that you can adapt to your own situation. Maybe you find another farmer who would lease you a couple of acres and let you use some of his equipment or do some of the heavy tractor work for you. So, but if you go to libertyprairie.org, you get a good start.
Okay. And then was there something else about the, was it the Prairie Crossing program or Prairie Crossing Farm or something?
Prairie Crossing, all of this physical activity, the Farm Business Development Center and all of our on-the-ground work is at a place called the Prairie Crossing Farm, which is 100-plus acres of certified organic farmland out, we're like 18 miles outside of the downtown Chicago. And it came about as part of a larger project, which was to demonstrate that you could use the market forces that create suburban sprawl, kind of the everyone wanting a new house out in the suburbs, yada, yada, yada. But instead of consuming farmland, you could actually use it to protect farmland and open space and restore natural areas. So there's a community that we developed called Prairie Crossing. And again, you can look it up on the internet, prairiecrossing.com. And it's a new community that we built, 400 houses, but we did it in such a way that 70% of the project site is protected open space now, and has got restored prairies and wetlands and lakes, and actually catalyzed both the development of the Prairie Crossing Farm and the protection of another 5,000 acres immediately adjacent to the project.
Okay. Awesome.
So, again, prairiecrossing.com will point people in the right direction.
Cool. Okay. Ready for my final question?
Sure.
Okay, so it's kind of a doozy. And that might be the answer, but if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or a project you would like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Michael, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
I think the greatest challenge is the complexity of the myriad of problems that we face. And the challenge is that everyone wants simple answers. And so my greatest wish, I guess, to deal with that is that people be ready to engage in serious discussion across the board with new ideas, with conflicting ideas, that groups that have traditionally not talked, that a perfect one is the conservation community and the farm community, historically have been in completely separate kind of groups and haven't talked a lot, and yet they share this passion about our greatest natural resource, which is land and soil. And they are the people, the frontline people in terms of managing that resource. So the sooner that the farm community and the conservation community learn how to talk to each other and respect each other, they may not always agree, but they'll come a lot closer to solving some of those kinds of problems. And the impact ranges from everything from human health in terms of the quality of the food we eat, the quality of the water that runs off of our land, the amount of carbon that we sequester in our soils and with the subsequent reduction of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. I mean, just those kinds of conversations can have a huge impact. So that would be my one and only, but it's more complex than saying send $50 to save the world.
Oh, I love it. I'm always about cooperation. I think that's perfect. I think, I don't know, just because like I am such a passionate liberal, but yet I, you know, live in a very conservative area, grew up in a very conservative area for that point. And like, I still have friends and, you know, I still get along, and just some of our, you know, arguments are the most fun about our, you know, conversations. And I always feel like people, you know, you should be able to, I get frustrated when people are like, I just can't talk to that person, or I can't, you know, it's like, you know, finding that common ground. So, but being able to express your passions without people being like, I can't talk about that. You know, like, you have your opinion, I have my opinion, and, you know, certainly there's things that we agree on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
An inspirational quote?
Or a tip, or just like an idea.
Actually, you know what? There's one I always like. Let me just quickly.
Yeah.
There's a Wendell Berry quote that I have always loved, which is, what I stand for is what I stand on.
Nice. I just took his book out of the library. I haven't read it yet. What is it? The Unsettling of America? Because a couple of people on my show have recommended it. I hadn't even heard of him until I started my podcast. So
yeah, he's one of the great old wise men of kind of rural living and the world. He can be a crank sometimes, but he's an amazing guy.
Cool. Okay. All right. And just, do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you? Would they just go to the same way I did, I guess, the Liberty Prairie Foundation, or?
Yep. Liberty Prairie Foundation. So it's libertyprairie.org. And all of our staff people are there with our email addresses and short bios. And you're welcome to contact me. I love to talk to people.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I knew this interview was packed full of golden nuggets and just lots of good information for people and inspiration and lots of diverse answers there. So I think you were a very knowledgeable guest. Shared a lot with us.
Well, great. I look forward to seeing the podcast when you got it edited.
Okay.
Your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.